Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really excited today to be speaking with Mike Rupert. Haven't seen you for a while, Mike, and a lot has been going on. Welcome.
Thank you, Sue. It's good to see you again.
Yeah, we've been doing interviews since 9/11, and you had brought so much information about that. And, of course, you wrote the book Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil. Just came out. It was about to come out, I think, last time that we spoke. And I want to let people know that your website is fromthewilderness.com. And there you can get all kinds of what I think is cutting-edge information. And you have quite a following, and it's well-deserved because you certainly put yourself out on the front lines there and educated many of us about the depths of the cover-up in corruption and how things really, really work in terms of money and power and drugs and 9/11 and just right. A lot of things. We are here at Soul Fest, actually, in Hopland, California. Some people know it as Real Goods, the Solar Living Institute. It's a big festival. So you've been talking about sustainability. And I just want to ask you right off the bat, I think you made some statement that was really pressing some people's buttons about 9/11 was over. You weren't going to deal with that anymore. And since you've been such a leader in exposing and making people really question and get to know about 9/11 being an inside job, I wonder why you said that.
Well, 9/11 isn't over. It will never be over any more than any of the great tragedies of American or world history will ever be over. Slavery isn't over. Many of the great crimes of this country are not over. In terms, however, of having a remotely viable window for pursuing 9/11 in the court of political justice, 9/11 is over. We, of course, saw George Bush and Dick Cheney steal the 2000 election. We saw them again steal the 2004 election with proprietary software that can't be controlled or audited. The media has declared it dead. The so-called independent commission, the Cain Commission, closed out its report, which was just an abysmal pack of lies and a horrible insult to the American people's intelligence. The major media has passed by 9/11. In other words, all of the available windows to pursue anything with 9/11 activism are really closed on the public venue. I am the ultimate pragmatist. I measure my success as an activist or a writer or an author in terms of changes in the political landscape. Whatever window existed to pursue 9/11 closed when the Cain Commission report closed it out, when the major media declared it was over, it had been resolved, looked at, it was time to move on. I very much, and this really has to do, really, it's a great corollary with the whole issue of peak oil, energy invested versus energy returned. And what I concluded, it was very clear to me early on this year in 2005, in the end of 2004, actually, that no matter what kind of energy was expended, we were not going to get 9/11 into a political venue where we would see either an impeachment or we would see an open political trial, any kind of hearing in Congress. All the congressional hearings are over. So that's why I said it was over. And I still believe that, because now we are facing very dangerous threats from both peak oil, which is now pretty much out of the closet and openly acknowledged, and climate collapse, which is happening. And these are life-threatening issues. As a policeman, I was concerned about saving lives in real time. Don't tell me about what ifs, what might be. I got to know what I can do right now.
Yeah, well, I can certainly relate to that. And it was from you that I first heard about peak. And you've been talking about it for a while, and you're oh so right. Well, I mean, we talk about the things that people don't want to hear about very often. Although I have noticed, it seems in my travels and talking to people, that there's a lot more people who don't flinch and get all upset when I just happen to mention 9/11 was an inside job, or, you know, don't talk about those terrorists from over there. It's, you know, that's not the real deal. So it seems to me like a lot more people are not all freaked out about that idea. Not that they're doing anything, or not that they think they can do anything or whatever, but I wonder, what's your experience, Mike Rupert? I find a lot more people have accepted that possibility, even though they're not being active about it or anything. It's not, doesn't shock them anymore.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm definitely seeing that. And I certainly see that reflected in where I'm being asked to speak now. I'm getting some major, major speaking invitations to major universities around the world. Pending, we have Georgetown, University of Colorado, we have UC San Diego. We've been asked to speak at, of course, the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. I've just been asked to speak at the Royal Society of Literature and History in Dublin, Ireland. So these things, yeah, people do tend to accept because psychologically, of course, as time passes from the event, it's easier to accept these contrarian theories. But again, so I'm still this pragmatist guy out there. I want to save lives. I want to teach people about what the immediate threats are. So I kind of say, well, people are saying, yeah, Mike, you were right. And well, I knew I was right, but so what? But now, how do we save more people's lives now? Because there is a direct connection between 9/11 and peak oil. And ultimately, I guess you can say this climate collapse that is now becoming also the elephant that you can no longer deny is standing in the middle of your living room.
Mm-hmm. We'll say more about that. And I just want to say that, of course, people can get your book, Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil. And I must say that I see people all over the place reading it. It's such a big, fat book. Mm-hmm. And so that's wonderful. And it's done well.
We sold about 100,000 copies, which makes Rubicon the second largest selling book about the attacks of 9/11 after the Kane Commission report. And it was just funny because a good friend of mine, Barry Zwicker in Canada, who's a great journalist in Canada, I was writing a series for the Toronto Star, and he said, well, what mainstream publications have reviewed your book? And I said, none. And he said, why? And I said, because they cannot refute the research. I have 1,000 footnotes in the book. And so the only tactic the major press has had available to suppress my book is to just pretend as if it didn't exist. And in a way, that's kind of worked to our benefit, I think.
Well, I was just looking at the last chapter, actually, and where you're talking about oil as well, and maybe in other parts of the book, but we were both talking about peak oil mm-hmm. and climate change. And you just said that 9/11 was related to peak oil for sure and maybe to climate change. So if you would expand.
Well, peak oil was clearly the motive for the U.S. government to have facilitated and orchestrated the attacks of 9/11. It gave the U.S. government the rationale to invade Central Asia, Afghanistan, Iraq, which has the second largest reserves on the planet, to surround literally Saudi Arabia and Iran, both major and very significant producers. 60% of all the recoverable oil on the planet is in the Middle East. And in Crossing the Rubicon, we showed clearly from historical records that Dick Cheney and especially the National Energy Policy Development Group, his task force that was the ultra-secret task force that ran from January of 2001 through May of 2001, that's, in my opinion, and I still believe it to be the case, is where the deepest, darkest secrets of 9/11 are buried. That's where the oil majors and the oil producers and the major economists got together in a room and said, look, peak oil is here. We can't get away from it. The oils that is left is in the Middle East. How do we get to a place where we can go seize that oil? And look at that. And, of course, now we're awash in rumors and threats of war about an invasion of Iran. And I, for one, do not think that the world will permit, and I do not think we will invade Iran, simply because the rest of the world cannot do without Iranian oil. There's no place else to go. For several months now, this is late August of 2005, world oil demand has exceeded oil production, so it's very possible that we are at peak or past the peak now. We won't know for sure until maybe a year, 2 years after.
Isn't that what it means, what you just described? Isn't that what peak oil means, when demand exceeds supply?
Well, it's when you have used half of all the oil that's there. All oil production always follows a bell curve, and when you've used half, you're at the peak. And once you go down the peak, no matter how much money, no matter how much technology, no matter how much wishful thinking takes place, you will never be able to produce more oil. Every year you will look at diminishing production, but of course that happens now as world demand for oil is still exploding. China, of course, is a voracious consumer, but still far less than the U.S. So if we're over peak, we are now faced with a situation really where the world is faced with the crisis of overpopulation, 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy in every calorie of food. We use oil to transport strawberries from Chile to Los Angeles, lettuce from, ridiculous, stupid use of oil to transport food in this model of globalization. And globalization is dead, period. It's over. It cannot be sustained because 70% of the world's transportation is powered by oil. 95% of American transportation is powered by oil. So now, with climate collapse upon us, with economic collapse, I think very clear. I'm very strongly predicting a major economic collapse in this country at the end of 2005. We will see everybody discovering what many activists like myself, Richard Heinberg, Julian Darley, Colin Campbell, all of us who have talked about it for so long, realizing that survival will now become a matter of locality. Everything is going to be local. Where you live. Food production will have to be local. Economics will have to be local. You're going to have to learn how to work with your neighbors. You're going to have to learn how to grow food in your backyard or close by because the oil won't be there to move it around. So that's the big push right now. That's the sense for urgency. And what's apparent to me is that the U.S. government is very much aware of this, and the U.S. government will actually aid in the collapse of the U.S. economy this year and encourage it. The reason I say that is because we have groups like the Bilderbergers and the Council on Foreign Relations now actively talking about demand destruction, which is a euphemism for economic collapse. The way you destroy demand is you throw tens of millions of people out of work. People who are unemployed don't buy gasoline, don't drive cars, don't take vacations, don't fly on airplanes, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's interesting. I always wondered how they could keep on growing, and think, who's going to buy this if people didn't have jobs. And
right.
So you think they kind of had that in mind?
Absolutely. Well, there's also the other thing is that the real financial elites in the United States, their money is no longer in this country. They have no vested interest. I mean, people who think that the Great Depression of the 1930s was cost the rich people anything are out of their mind. That didn't cost the rich. That was a wealth transfer. If you look at America, we're absolutely oversaturated and up to our eyeballs in debt with consumer goods. We've mortgaged our houses 2 and 3 times. The housing bubble's ready to collapse. Whereas in the rest of the developing world, and people in China and Malaysia and other people, you have people who don't have any of the, or very few of the consumer goods that we have, and that's a fresh market. So the elites of the world can go to sell for them for as long as that oil lasts to keep their paradigm going. But of course, we are literally standing in a pool of gasoline. This is because we soon may be having a nuclear conflict over oil reserves, which would make it all moot, of course, if we blow ourselves to smithereens to fight over oil.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. And I've been reading a bit about China and the From the Wilderness news that comes to me on my computer. So having a bit of an idea, but would you talk about how you see the geopolitical shifts?
Very clearly, the world is aligning against the United States. And the United States is, as I said in Rubicon, an empire entering decline. We are becoming a toothless tiger. But recently, we have had a number of strong declarations from Russia, China, India, about the U.S. getting out of Central Asia, removing our bases there. We have China and Iran forming economic alliances all over West Africa, which is a critical oil-producing region. And probably the best example, or the clearest one to understand, is President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who is every day literally giving the U.S. a big raspberry, saying that he'll sell oil to China. He's doing big deals with China, and he's being very successful. And I've been saying clearly for a long time that geography is going to determine what this post-petroleum world is going to look like. South America seems to be way ahead of the rest of the world in localizing itself into a regional, equitable, honest, self-sustaining alliance, a Bolivarian alliance, and Hugo Chavez, and I hope to visit Venezuela soon, possibly to interview Hugo Chavez. But we see the nations of the world aligning against the United States and challenging. And basically, China made a $200 billion investment in Iran, which makes it clear now that if the U.S. were to be foolish enough, and it will not, I really don't think the U.S. is going to invade Iran, that we would be attacking $200 billion in Chinese assets. So you can obviously add 2 plus 2 and say, that's nuclear war. Well, of course it is. And India's throwing money into Iran. et cetera, et cetera. Even Europe is throwing money into Iran. So the U.S. is becoming an empire in serious decline. And, of course, it should come as no surprise. We have watched empires rise and fall throughout the course of human history.
Right, and it's kind of right on schedule in terms of how long empires last. I remember noticing that was in India at a light show talking about, well, there was this sultan or this king, whatever, you know, and this happened and somebody else took over and it just went on and on, and I kind of got the impermanence of empire. And I would like to remind people that I'm speaking with Mike Rupert, the author of Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil, and also the editor and the publisher of FromTheWilderness.com.
That's me.
Yeah. So here we are at Soul Fest, You were talking about sustainability. That's what this Soul Fest is all about, which is very heartening. I mean, there's so many wonderful things that we can be doing. And when you were talking earlier about transportation, Mike, I wanted to say that, you know, people think, oh, they just think they'll get some other kind of car, and they just think that that's all there is, but they don't think about how much oil is involved in everything in the industrialized world, including the manufacturing.
Yes.
And the whole thing about preparing is you can't wait till it comes, because then to run out and get your solar panels, because when there's not enough oil to manufacture the solar panels, well, I don't know, I guess you get electricity from solar, but you get my drift, say more.
Well, that's what I've been fighting more than anything else to get people to incorporate into their way of thinking is a term called net energy. People automatically assume that a hybrid, for example, will just appear out of nowhere, and they don't even think about how much energy goes into making the hybrid. It takes 12 to 15% of all the oil that a car will ever consume, even a hybrid, to make the vehicle. You got to mine the ore, drive it by oil to someplace, melt the ore, you got to move it down, all plastic is made out of oil, which means that for a Toyota Prius or a Honda hybrid or whatever, it's going to take about 2,500 gallons of oil to make that vehicle. Now, with 700 million internal combustion-powered vehicles, that's about 1.5, 1.6 trillion, with a T, gallons of gasoline if we were to replace the world's whole fleet. There are 7 gallons of gasoline in every tire. People don't think about this, what the cost is. And that doesn't account for the energy to build the factories to build the cars.
Right. I remember hearing how much oil it took to make one computer chip and one computer. Anyway, these things are huge,
yes.
Just huge. All these things that we take for granted, they're all based on oil.
Absolutely. And people need to start thinking in terms of net energy because, of course, psychologically, everybody wants a quick and easy answer. There is no complete answer to peak oil. There is no solution. And what's scary to me is now we see Chevron and Mobil on their websites publicly acknowledging peak oil. Now, 2 years ago, they didn't do that in their financial reports, in their quarterly filings, their 10-Ks and 14-Qs. They said, we have plenty of reserves. Now they're saying, well, then no, we're going to run out, and maybe 3 to 5 years we'll hit peak. Well, that means we're probably at peak now, and they know that. And if they're saying that really scares me. But so now peak oil can no longer be postponed or evaded. And it's going to get real tough, and people have to disabuse themselves of any fanciful notions, because now if you make the wrong guess based upon denial or psychological need, it may cost you your life.
Did you hear that, folks?
That's right. I mean, this is serious. I'm all about saving lives, and saving lives is about sustainability. One of the things that has made me so mad, and one of my new biggest villains in the world, is Monsanto. I mean, what they've done with agribiz and patenting seeds, they've just patented a pig, Terminator seeds. See, this is why I always say, until you change the way money works, you can't change anything else. But we have been robbed of the American people's knowledge of farming. Two generations ago, everybody knew how to farm. Now, we know how to buy groceries. That's what we know how to do. And we have pavement, we have depleted topsoil and everything else. And when push comes to shove, it's going to be the ability to grow and procure food and fresh water and everything else that's going to determine who lives and who dies. And we're not far from that point now.
Yeah. Well, I totally agree. I started out on a farm, and I've been recently wanting to go back to one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, the industrial age has just been such a little blip in the history of humans on the planet. So it's, people have been getting along for a long time. But then all this oil has allowed all this population to outgrow the carrying capacity.
Well, not only that, of course, now we're seeing overwhelming evidence of climate collapse. We just have a new book that I've got for sale on our website called Climate Crash, which is elegantly understated because it's so terrifying. It had to be. We see the Greenland ice sheet melting, you know, in measures of feet per year. We see the sea levels rising all around England. It's a very interesting thing that on July the 7th, the day of the London bombings, had those bombings not taken place, the biggest story in the world would have been Blair breaks with Bush on global warming at G8. And the British know what's coming. Their islands are sinking.
Mm-hmm. And islands are sinking all over the world, of course.
That's exactly right. And then the story came out just about a week ago that it's been acknowledged that the Russian tundra is thawing out. And what that's doing is releasing, and this is a quote from the BBC, billions, with a B, of tons of methane directly into the atmosphere because the natural gas was frozen under the tundra. And now it's melting. Now, methane is 20 times more deadly a greenhouse gas than is carbon dioxide. And billions of tons, and we're already in the middle of global warming, that could be well past the tipping point. And what the books like Climate Crash and The Real Science now shows is that climate changes, abrupt climate changes, like ice ages, have taken place historically in less than a year's time. Mm-hmm. They can happen that quickly.
I think they can happen instantly, right? Because they're those dinosaurs with the undigested food frozen.
Or woolly mammoths, yeah. Yes, and that's true. And this is why the record from the Greenland ice sheet, which gives perfect ice core samples, and that's a global thing. It didn't just happen in Greenland. Greenland just measured what was happening on a global scale. So we are precariously close to a whole raft of life-threatening situations. And, of course, when somebody's life is in danger, thinking as a policeman, as I was trained so many years ago, when somebody's life is in danger, you don't think about a historical debate or a legal action or something else having to do with 9/11. You think about saving people's lives, and that's what I'm focused on.
Yeah. I wonder how you deal with your fear. I'm so struck. Well, I have my own fear, too, for sure. And I deal with it, and it goes away, and then it comes back, and I deal with it again. And there's so much of the denial, which is really a big issue, because people don't prepare. Well, as you said earlier, it's a matter of life and death.
Right.
So how do you deal with that with all this information?
Well, I should have been dead a long time ago. I have avoided death many times in my life. I've been shot at twice when I was whistleblowing on the CIA dealing drugs. I've had a couple of close near-death experiences, so every day I have now is gravy, and the only day that I ever have, that I ever have to work on anything is today. Today, I have now, that's it.
So you really can do that?
Yeah, I can, and I have to in order to be effective. I mean, of course, there are times when it gets to you, when it gets heavy, and then you just take some little time out to play and go be frivolous, act the Three Stooges, whatever you have to do, mm-hmm. and that gives you some balance back. Because we're not alone. You know, there is a reality greater than mankind. And whether you call it nature or God, in whatever form you understand it, there is a power greater than us, and it's accessible. And there was a great thinker, and I forget who it was. It was somebody from probably the Renaissance or later who said, even if you told me there was only a 1 in 1,000 chance that things might turn out okay, it's that keeps me showing up every day. And it's not about, for me, I don't look at it as saving 6.5 billion lives. I look at it as saving the lives that I can touch, and that's it. And that's all I worry about.
Yeah. It's really changed my perspective, I'll tell you. I mean, since I met you, my perspective has changed about a lot of things.
I do that to a lot of people. Yeah, I know. I have that effect on people.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful, and you're brave, and it's really important to speak the truth as we know it, and a lot of people don't have the courage. So, Mike Rupert, you do.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it's great to be here at Soulfest. We talk about these heavy, life-threatening things, but yet we get to walk out here and hear some world-class music, have a party, eat some great food, you know, and that's what it's all about. We have to keep our balance facing everything, you know. Life will go on. The human race may not go on. Life will always go on. You know, in 4.5 billion years of Earth's history, no matter what happened, life has always survived. And I'm not egotistical enough to think that my wisdom or anything else needs to survive.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a lot of people talk about saving the planet. I say, we better save ourselves or whatever, save the humans. The planet's going to be around.
It is time to start building lifeboats, absolutely. Yeah. And nobody's going to build them for us, lifeboats.
I want to ask you something. You said about the, as we just said like a minute or two, you earlier said about the United States having something to do with climate change. Could you just say a little bit more about that?
Well, the United States government, through its, of course, it's rejected Kyoto, and it's way too late for Kyoto to make any difference. Good science says that, you know, we're past a tipping point. But the U.S. government's economic and military policies have continued to encourage rampant consumption of hydrocarbon energy, overproduction of greenhouse gases. And, of course, our military is probably not helping too much with all of the oil that we burn. But the U.S. government has, look, we're 5% of the world's population consuming 25% of the world's energy. And that's how you get greenhouse gases. You burn hydrocarbon fuel. So, and that has been abused. It's been encouraged. Dick Cheney and George Bush said the American way of life is not negotiable, and I can guarantee you that Mother Nature is laughing her ass off.
Well, and what do you think about the police state that seems to be planned and is already happening for some people, and so many things that can't really, do you think that the end of oil is going in economic collapse is going to exchange these things, or is it going to kind of slow them down or stop them or make them worse?
Well, I look at the numbers strictly because I was trained in some of this stuff with the Los Angeles Police Department, even when I interned in the chief's office way back in 1970-71. Is that if you do a manpower analysis, the U.S. government does not have the manpower to impose a police state in this country in terms of the way people think about it. What the U.S. government probably has the power to do, and this is clearly spelled out in their priorities for homeland security and a number of other pieces of legislation, is to protect their critical infrastructure, to protect their computers, their communications systems, et cetera, but I think that aside from maybe the necessity of quarantining or clamping down on one or two small cities, they don't have the manpower beyond that. So I think ultimately they're going to be forced to a position of letting the rest of this country just fall to pieces, which is another argument, I think, for why people should really be looking to sustainability and localization. Because, there ain't going to be no Santa Claus or Tooth Fairy coming to bail us out.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Mike Rupert, author of Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil, publisher of FromTheWilderness.com, FromTheWilderness.com website, and many, many, many other things. And thank you so much for this interview. I'm so glad you could squeeze it in up here on Soulfest.
Sue, we've been doing this for 4 years. Let's do it for four more.
That's fine with me. Stay well, Mike.
Bye-bye.
I'm Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. To hear other programs produced by Sue Supriano, go to my website, www.suesupriano.com. And Sue Supriano is spelled SUESUPRIANO.